Chapter 14. Sire Gimbal Pays a Call. Somehow, anyone with appreciable talent was affected by the spell, I explained to Alia while we breakfasted in private, in the ground floor sitting chamber of our tower residence, a few days after my tour of the Thawing Vales. She looked confused as she hauled out a boob to feed greedy little Manalion, who was eating every 3 hours. Alia looked exhausted. Enough so that old Peg insisted on bringing in a young wet nurse, a native Sevendori woman from Bestal village named Darishi. She was a pretty little thing, and you wouldn't think she'd be able to get enough milk for one infant out of her modest assets, let alone two. But she tried valiantly, and was successful enough to really help ease the strain on Alia. Darishi rarely spoke, and seemed overawed by us both. It was as if she was worried I'd turn her and her daughter into toads if she displeased us at first, and considering the changes I'd made around the castle, I suppose a little trepidation on her part was understandable. It took a few days to get her to relax a little, and of course she was well compensated for her trouble. Come spring, her husband and she would have 5 new goats, 6 chickens, and a work mule at my expense. That was on top of the bushel of seed corn and 2 sheep, a ram and a ewe, that they would receive as part of the spring planting. She was still asleep then, as my son had kept her up most of the night. Alia said thoughtfully,
I don't understand. I thought you said Magi discovered their talents in puberty, she pointed out, as she rocked the baby at her breast and ate a muffin.
That's usually when they arise, I agreed, but everyone is different. Talent is very poorly understood. It always has been. Even in the Magocracy, it was difficult to predict which children would have it, even in families of mage lords, and some actually found their talent later in life, sometimes as old as 30. There was a whole class of magi in the Magocracy who specialized in finding and developing talent, but most of their techniques have been lost since the conquest. Some of them really didn't have talent beyond the ability to spot other people with talent. That reminded me of something else. And then there are what are sometimes known as sports. She nodded. She was familiar with sports. Like a 3-headed calf. I agreed as I buttered another biscuit. They weren't nearly as good as my dad's, of course, but far better than those I'd enjoyed on campaign. The ovens were doing far better work now. Same principle, except instead of 2 additional heads, an arcane sport exhibits a profound but limited talent. A lot of water witches and beast masters are like that. They're outstanding about finding and channeling water, or taming and training an animal, but beyond that, nothing.
That doesn't sound so bad,
she conceded, looking down at the baby protectively. Tell that to the censorate, I said, rolling my eyes. They have a lower tolerance for sports than most magi. There's a process for registration, if the sport is deemed harmless or impotent. But even that is difficult to acquire. It's easier just to kill you, imprison you, or burn out the part of your brain that can do magic. She made a face at that. I'd described the process to her once. It sounded innocuous enough, until you realized that several of the parts of the brain that help you do magic also help you do things like talk, see, and reason cogently, and control your bodily functions. Madness was a regular result. And there were almost always some nasty side effects. Sometimes an execution was a more humane alternative. Yet another reason to hate the censorate. But it was an intriguing avenue of consideration, now that the power of the censorate was broken. Sometimes sports can produce someone very useful, but more often than not they're just curiosities. Like a man who can plough a perfectly straight row every time, or someone who can sense the feelings of animals.
But these sports, why don't they have more talent?
We don't know, I repeated. It's not just a matter of a lot or a little, I think. It's also what your mind and body have the capacity to handle. In some cases, the effect does resemble the equivalent of a 3-headed cow. Why does it happen? There were a lot of wild theories thrown around the table at the academy, late at night, when the magisters were asleep. My best guess is that it's a combination of factors. Your lineage would certainly have something to do with it, but so does environment. How you grow, I suppose you'd say. Just as every tree will have a different number of apples on it,
Every person has a different measure and form of talent. So what makes Magi different than everyone else? She asked curiously. She changed tits. She was almost effortless with it now. Not everyone was, old Peg had told me more than once. Today. It was tantalizing. They'd been among my favourite features of her when we met, and now that they were being used for their intended purpose, they were ever-present, but tantalizingly out of reach for the indefinite future. I tried to distract myself with lore. Essentially, a mage is someone whose talent is strong enough and across enough forms to allow the mage to employ a symbol system, combined with a profound concentration of will and mental acuity, to make the universe around them do what they want. In its highest form, it takes an understanding of reality and physics far deeper than most men. If their talent is compelling enough, they learn how to use it by necessity, regardless of what paperwork they fill out. Those are the people the censorate usually goes after. They'll investigate a sport, and if they find the talent dangerous or of sufficient strength to cause worry, they either burn out the parts of the brains that use magic, or they simply order them executed. More rarely, they'll take them away to Wenchar for study. It's happened. She shuddered. And you're saying Manalion is in danger of that? He was. He might still be. Personally, I'm more worried about him choking to death on the huge volume of milk he's eating a lot more. At the moment, so am I, she chuckled, and then winced. Damn, this hurts. So, you were saying, about the spell. How much to tell her, when I didn't know much about what happened myself at all. Right. The spell. When I was summoned to help, there was a kind of magical attachment, almost like an umbilicus, between you and the baby. That's true with every mother and child, to a certain extent, from what I remember from school. But for whatever reason, Manalion's wouldn't sever. I guess he was happy and comfortable where he was. More importantly, and this is my theory now, when he was confronted with facing the world outside of your protective shroud, he had the ability to somehow resist, in force. When the trauma of birth happened, he just latched on. I had no idea what to do, so I improvised. It felt like a binding spell, so I tried a simple counterspell. And for good measure, I added a prayer to Brigga, I added to myself. I don't know why, but I didn't want to mention that to anyone just yet. There's also the magical channels I'd already opened here, naturally, the lines of force I'd run through the tower when we first got here. If that had any effect or not, I don't know. But whatever I did worked, and the separation occurred. Thank you, she said quietly. I guess I never really said that. At the time, I thought I was dying. I nodded. I didn't want to tell her she really had been dying, or it might upset her. So whatever happened upstairs in the birthing chamber apparently swept out over the valley like a wave. You've seen what it did to every bit of silica.
Silica?
She asked, confused. It's what most rocks are made from, I explained. It was an overly simplistic explanation, but it worked for the moment. And sand. The wave imbued the silica with a kind of energy, and transformed it, enchanted it. I thought the effect would fade, but it seems to be permanent. And no, I still don't know why or how. I've never read anything about it, even in the Magocracy. Believe me, that sort of thing would have been noted. That has big implications for Sevendor, I realized. We have the only deposit of it known, and I have a feeling it could be invaluable as a means of lowering magical resistance in the field. Even beyond the stone, anyone in the Vale who had an undeveloped talent, or just underdeveloped, reacted strongly to it, by vomiting.
So, what does that mean now?
I shrugged. I have no idea, but I have had Sir Kay make a list of everyone who reported throwing up that day. I'm going to bring them all up here eventually and run tests on everyone. In all of my abundant spare time, I said wryly. I was already lingering far too long in my warm quarters with my wife and son, while Sir Kay, Ferrando, and my many yeomen and attendants were bustling about, actually getting things done. I almost felt guilty.
I threw up, she pointed out hesitantly. Are you saying I have talent?
Maybe, I conceded. But I discount your vomit.
Thanks,
I snickered. I thought you'd appreciate that. From what your attendants told me, it's pretty common for a woman in labour to throw up, bleed, shit herself.
Yes, the dignity of childbirth,
she said, disdainfully, making a face. Our blessing from Trig. Now you know why men are usually banned from the chamber. It becomes hard to maintain your feminine allure once you've seen your lady
that way.
Don't worry about me, I said reassuringly. I'd be willing to drag you to bed right now if you were up to it.
5 more weeks,
she warned me with a groan and a frightened expression.
Really? At least?
Calm yourself. I'm too busy to even think about sex right now. Not only are we still dealing with the aftermath of the blizzard and trying to get everyone properly settled and fed, we also have those ransoms to negotiate, craftsmen to hire, militia to train, and 8,000 repairs that this castle needs before it's even truly livable, much less defendable. Believe me, you'll be the first to know when I have time for the next erotic thought in my head. Sure, I was lying. It was the polite thing to do.
Just making sure,
she said, biting her lip.
I know how you get.
That stopped me. We had only known each other for less than a year, even though we were married and had a child. And considering that we were just now getting comfortable with each other as husband and wife, I was curious about her observations.
How exactly do I get?
She looked at me thoughtfully.
Let's revisit that later, shall we?
She decided after another moment of consideration.
So back to the spell. Just how many threw up?
I allowed her to change the subject. I wasn't in the mood to pick a fight. About a dozen, maybe a dozen and a half so far. I ran down the list Sir Kay had compiled from the districts. The majority were Bovali, which I found intriguing. It supported the theory that wild outcroppings of Irionite could effectively enchant the soil and water in which the people lived, improving the strength of talent. Sir Kay himself was on the list, but only 4 native Sevendori. The worst reaction had been a young girl in Westwood, who had become violently ill that night. She had recovered, it was said, but she had a white streak permanently burned in her red hair as a result. But the one which this might affect the most is Sir Festeran, the young knight we're holding for ransom at Brestal Hall. The others I can watch, since they're Sevendori now. But if he has appreciable talent, or is even a strong sport, then he could be developed and trained, and he could be a mage lord, or at least a knight mage. Under the censorate, even that much talent would place him under jurisdiction of the bans, and it would lose him his inheritance and his title.
The censorate. I still have nightmares of Talry, when those two almost caught poor Tyndall. If it hadn't been for Pentandra.
She shook her head to clear the vision, which disturbed the baby. I was almost amazed to hear my wife speak so well of my former lover. Pregnancy changes a woman.
I don't know how you could stand living with that danger looming over you all the time.
I didn't like them much at all, I agreed. That's why I try to find a place as remote from them as possible, like, say, Bovall Vale, as far away from the censorate as I could get, off in the Alshari Wilderlands. Quaint little mountain community. Perfectly safe, I said with a straight face. Alya rolled her eyes prettily. She was recovering from her delivery, but it was slow going. The puffiness was subsiding, at least. But back to our current problems. I have a theory regarding the stone. It's now easier to do magic here, I said, conjuring a bright red mage light for effect and distracting Menalion from his teat. It's more than just having access to power. That's the Irionite. This just makes it easier for your spells to hook or grab or flow or whatever they need to do. It's like I've been exercising in a suit of armor and got to take it off for the first time. It's a proximity issue, I think. But I'm going to experiment with Sir Festeran, have him carry a few pieces around in his pockets, very quietly, so the other prisoners don't get wind. He's isolated from the rest of the snowstone.
Is that what you're calling it? I like it.
So did Sir Kay. So if he carries just a sample around, I can see if his talent emerges at all, compared to how he reacts before he carried it. And if that's true, I shrugged. I really didn't know what that meant.
And how did the little guy here pull that off?
I have even less idea about that. Goris wants to call it a sign from the gods. I'd chalk it up to a freak magical accident due to a unique set of circumstances. There are precedents, I pointed out, and then realized that Alia had studied cows, not magic. The Citrine Malapar, the Veil of Sorrows, even the sinking of Perwin. Crazy accidents or spells gone wrong that led to unexpected results. Sometimes tragic. Only this time we, redecorated a mountain. Don't you think that's going to attract attention? She asked. From those men in checkered cloaks who want to kill you. Which ones? I moaned. Why do you think I'm building this castle, rebuilding it? So I have some place to make a stand, some walls to hide behind. But yes, they will know about it, and they will come to see it, and I will probably have to drive them away. But I'm also going to put that off as long as possible. So don't tell any censors about it, okay? And all of these? What if it turns out that these vomiting villagers will become sports, or more? You'll have a bunch of wild magi on the loose. That's going to attract attention too, isn't it? Among other problems. Again, I have no idea. I sighed. She was right. She smirked. I'm starting to think that should be your noble motto. What would that be in old High Perwanese? Oh, bide, I said, as I felt the beginnings of a mind-to-mind communication. Alia nodded and started burping the baby, who was starting to show signs of satiation. I opened myself to the spell and was speaking with Rondal, who was stationed up at the dike tower at the moment.
Master, I thought you should know. We have visitors.
Oh, really? What kind and how many?
Quite a few, and quite an assortment, he reported wryly. A delegation of 6 from West Flaria, 2 peasants from southern Sendaria with a train of trade goods for market. They've been travelling for 4 days and got caught in the blizzard, and a green mage.
A what? A green mage?
Yes, that's what he says. He also says that you sent for him, or something like that.
I searched my memory. Had I? I'd summoned a number of tradesmen, and while I had been wishing devoutly for a green mage, or at least to know more green magic, I hadn't really investigated the matter further than wishing. Of course, I'd been wishing pretty hard. Tell me, is he a foot wizard, or is he chartered?
Chartered,
Rondal assured me. That was the first thing I asked. He had his papers. He's out of Central Rhymer, and he's been a practicing journeyman for 12 years, apprenticed under a master Ulmekinus. He said he comes by the referral of one Planus, a practical adept in Rhymer.
Oh, all right, now I know what happened. I mentioned to Pentandra that I wanted one. I guess wishing on a penny is as good as a spell.
Very funny, Master,
Rondal said, without betraying a trace of humour. What about the West Flarians? The hostage negotiations, I take it.
3 knights, 2 retainers and a squire. Among them is our old friend Sir Brommel, but they are led by no less than Sire Gimbal himself. Only a token escort, but they are armed for a fight. There might be more farther down the road. At least that's what the peasants indicated. The Flarians were upset that I dealt with them and the mage first, but they were here first, too.
Tell them all to bide, and that you have summoned the mage lord. I decided, after a few moments' thought. Make certain that they are treated courteously and offer them refreshments.
Yes, Master. Anything else?
Keep the gate guards on alert, and pass word down to the construction camp at Brestol Farms. That was the site of the new village and manor I was restoring in the northern part of the valley, closest to our gate. There were at least 50 Bavali workmen there, even in the wake of the snowstorm. They were that eager to get homes built for their families. While they didn't have much armour, I'd made sure the guard tower was well supplied with spears and bows and swords. But tell them to be very quiet about it. You may pass the peasants on through. What are they carrying?
Not much, he admitted. Cheese, sausages, potatoes and carrots. Some cowhides, a couple of bags of random crap. They probably have more that they aren't mentioning, but they seem harmless enough.
Let them through, I repeated. Keep the green mage there as long as he doesn't start any trouble.
He's just sitting there, like he's got no place better to be.
All right. I'll be up there as soon as I can. I ended the contact and then established a link with Tyndall, who was still on guard duty at Brestal Vale, long enough to give some orders. Then I opened my eyes.
I have to go to work, I sighed. Sire Gimble has come to negotiate for the hostages.
Tell him you need to be back by sundown, she said, pouting. I swear to Brigger, I think you make this stuff up just so you can get away from me and avoid unpleasant conversations.
Yes, that's it entirely, I agreed sweetly, kissing her forehead, and then the baby's. I got my face burped in and spit up on my shoulder for my trouble. And that, alas, was the high point of my day.
By now, Sir Ferrando's men were well practiced at deploying from the garrison at Breston Tower to the frontier dyke at short notice. So by the time I had armoured and armed myself, and roused the rest of the household, then rode Traveller at a gallop to the gate, there were 24 horsemen milling about, waiting for me. For that matter, the Bovalley camp at Brestal Farms had deployed themselves as militia, unbidden. The top of the dyke bristled with Wilderland's bows, spears, shields, and pragmatic peasants, as did the archer galleries atop the tower, and the redoubts on either flank. Sir Kay and Rondal were also present, girded for war. I was about as prepared as I could be. I didn't wear armour, but I had 4 or 5 war wands on my person, my witch sphere, and twilight slung over my saddle, and it beat fighting with Alia.
"How's his mood?" I asked Rondal, as I dismounted and pulled off my gloves.
"He's incredibly patient," my apprentice said with a grin. "Indeed, his lordship reminds us just how patient he is being with every other breath. Sire Gimble is the very essence of patience, as he has assured me, repeatedly."
"I see," I nodded. "Have you scried out their reinforcements?" I asked. It wouldn't have occurred to Tyndall, but Rondal was more thoughtful that way.
He nodded. 2 dozen mounted sergeants and about 2x that many light infantry. They're 1/2 mile back, at the holding closest to the frontier, waiting for orders.
Sir Ferrando rode up and joined us, wearing his customary battered but still somewhat ornate armour. He was remarkably calm, almost casual.
"We outnumber them heavily, sire," he reported, "but I don't think there will be fighting. It appears to be a negotiation."
"They seem to be prepared for either eventuality," I said, and explained how Rondal had scried their reinforcements. "Have 12 stealthy archers sent to scout them. Don't fire. Just observe. I trust you know the men for the job."
"Ancient Dalcalan, Horo and Ganon," he said at once. "They can pick the rest of their men. They've been doing a little poaching on the other side of the frontier," he added with a twinkle in his eye.
I sighed. That was dangerous. Poaching within another lord's domain was grounds for on-the-spot execution, if you were caught red-handed, and the nobility was so inclined under the law. Still, the temptation to add a little extra meat to the stew pot at the expense of a neighbouring fief was too great for most peasants to resist. "Then move the rest of the horses back beyond the tower, and have the men keep in readiness there. They likely won't be needed, but if they are, I want them to have enough field to get up to a gallop."
"Well thought, mage lord," grunted Ferrando, and he rode off to deliver my orders.
Sir Kay arrived with a blue bag, which proved to contain my lordly regalia, my circlet, the glowing emerald, the whole bit. He'd even brought my staff, which I thought was a bit much. I hadn't really done much with it since I'd gotten my witchstone, but I suppose it did look imposing, if you didn't know a thing about magic. I had built it when I was a spellmonger to impress the peasants. Perhaps it worked on belligerent knights, too. I took it without comment. I was hoping that Sire Gimble was the kind of man impressed by such things. "This is your first dealing as a landholding lord with another landholding lord. Remember, sire, this is your domain," Sir Kay prompted me unnecessarily, but enthusiastically. "You have both the law and righteousness on your side, and you are capable of defending your domain. He will try to intimidate you, bait you, and try to challenge your honour in order to gain advantage in the negotiations. Do not lose your temper, and count to 3 in your mind before you speak. It gives the perception of thoughtfulness and deliberation." "I don't think I'll have a problem," I said, a little irritated at the advice. But then again, I'd be a fool to ignore his advice, I knew. This was my first time conducting inter-domain affairs, I realized, as I put the circlet that signified my lordship on my brow.
If I screwed it up, a lot of people could die, including me. That was a sobering thought, especially in light of my recent fatherhood. When I was properly attired, I gathered my entourage. I took just Sir Kay and Rondal, three to match their three, though Ferrando and the watch captain of the guard hung back a bit, in case we needed anything, a horn around his neck to summon reinforcements. Once we were in good order, we made our way through the gateway on foot, through the snow. Sir Kay continued to whisper irritatingly helpful advice in my ear until we reached the dike. The archers on the berm wall perked up as we passed, and I tossed them a wave. They looked eager for a scrap, too, though no arrows were drawn. We found Sire Gimple. Sir Brummel and a third knight were sitting on portable stools around a portable table, drinking wine out of small silver glasses like gentlemen while we waited. Tyndall was standing nearby, his arms crossed over his chest as he watched them warily. He'd arrived before we did, on orders, and had been tasked to be our herald and see to the comfort of our guests. He wasn't the best choice, perhaps, but if trouble started, he was my best war mage. The three knights stood as they noted my approach, and their attendants rushed forward to take their stools and stand at the ready. Sire Gimble, the war bird of West Flaria, was shorter than I imagined, the top of his head coming up to my chin, and I'm not particularly tall. He had a lean face with a recently trimmed beard and broad shoulders for his frame, hiding under his rich red woolen mantle. When he stood, I saw he was a little bow-legged, too. He was wearing a fine chain-mail hauberk and coif over a leather gambeson, with a red and white surcoat over, and a broad red sash across his chest with the device, a warbird, whatever that was, embroidered on it. Sir Brummel, who was dressed similarly, I was familiar with, but the third knight was a surprise. Sir Arendal. He looked little better than I'd last seen him. If anything, the gin blossoms on his face were worse, and he didn't look as well-fed as before. He was also the least well-dressed of the three, wearing a plain leather ring-mail hauberk that stretched to his knees, and no surcoat. It was the kind of armour suitable for a senior sergeant or a very, very poor country knight. He glared daggers at me the entire time, though he was extremely deferential to Sire Gimble. "I am given to understand that you are Sire Gimble of West Flaria," I said, without bowing. Sire Kay had instructed me that, as ostensible host in this negotiation, I was not obligated to begin in a servile position unless I feared retribution. Looking at this little man, I wasn't particularly fearful. "I am Sire Minelan, Mage Lord of Sevendor, made vassal by the hand of His Grace, Rad, Duke of Castile. In a civil negotiation, as opposed to a military one, it would not have been proper to introduce myself for some reason," Sir Kay had told me. "It would have been impolite not to have my castellan or herald introduce me. Since this was a military matter, I could introduce myself." Who knew?
"I am Sire Gimble, the warbird of West Flaria," he said boldly but quietly, in a deep voice that captured your attention, "and I am given to understand that you have kidnapped several of my knights."
"Kidnapped?" I asked, feeling my men tense around me. "Nay, Sire Gimble, they were lawfully taken hostages upon losing duels that they themselves sought."
"Did not Sir Cerberal inform you of the circumstances of his and his comrade's capture?" Sir Kay asked curiously.
"Is not Sir Cerberal in your custody?" asked Sir Brummel, troubled.
"He was released upon pledge of ransom for the purpose of informing his liege of his fellow's predicament," Sir Kay said, his lips twitching with a smile. "Did he not return?"
"No," Sir Brummel said, his eyebrows knitting together. "No, he did not. In fact, we would have had no word of our knights had not a peasant boy stumbled in 4 days ago, telling a tale of their kidnapping. You swear you sent him free unharmed?"
"On my son's life," I nodded. "He was free, if lightly armed, and on a horse when he departed Sevendor. It was just before the blizzard."
"The blizzard, the peasants say you stirred up," Sire Brummel murmured. "We heard rumour of a duel, but we also heard of kidnapping. Young Sir Cerberal did not return. For his sake, I hope he froze to death rather than forgot his honour and fled."
"It's possible," Tyndall said, shrugging.
He's probably feeling pretty ashamed. I bested him in the duel. Badly. He's got decent footwork and passable swordplay, but no instinct for the fight. He attacks haphazardly and lets his anger direct his blows, and it's clear he's never actually fought for his life before. Sir Kay, Sir Ferrando, and the other professional men-at-arms had been working with him since he arrived at Yule. That gave him a far more traditional fighting style than mine, as war magi don't usually emphasize the knightly sort of dueling in favor of techniques more suited to our profession. But his assessment was fair. "That is, indeed, his fighting style," Sir Brommel said with a single nod. "I trained him myself, and I have oft said his blows were rash and ill-planned. So there was a duel," he sighed heavily. "Several, actually," I conceded, "but we did not instigate them." I was about to explain the whole episode, and thought better of it. "Gentlemen," I began again calmly, "since we are of but recent acquaintance, I understand how you might doubt my veracity in this. In an effort to be just, I have summoned the hostages here so that they may tell you the tale themselves, in their own voices." Sir Brommel's left eyebrow went up, and the war bird of Westphalia snorted and huffed, but then gave a curt nod. I turned to Rondal and gave the barest of nods. He departed quickly, but without haste. Tyndall had brought all of the boys up from Brestold Tower upon my orders, where they were waiting behind the dyke wall. "While we are waiting," Sir Brommel began after a moment's awkward silence, "perhaps you can explain to us just how you came to hold Sevendor, as Sir Erenthal assures us you do." Erenthal looked a little guilty, but said nothing. "Needless to say, we could not doubt the word of a gentleman, a faithful steward of the realm, who looked upon the charter with his own eyes." He said it as if he expected me to contradict the man. I was unsure of what tales Erenthal had told his hosts, but that much, at least, was true. So I told them a pared-down version of how I had been in the wrong place at the wrong time, defended the Bovali against the dead god, escaped with our lives, and then, weeks later, led a powerful army against the goblin hordes, was knighted on the field as the head of my order, and was rewarded with Sevendor and a once heavy chest of gold for my efforts. They looked at me, mouths agape, as I told the tale. At the end of it, not a one of them looked convinced. "So," the war bird of Westphalia said with a sneer, "you are a common baker's son." "That's what he was concerned with?" "My father is an uncommonly good baker, a respected master of his craft. But I am not a baker, just a baker's son. Among other things," I shrugged. "Spellmonger, war mage, knight magi, mage lord." I said the last with a special emphasis. "So you say," he said, his voice dripping with contemptuous disbelief. "News came from the west that his grace overturned the bans, and as outrageous as that sounds, I am advised that the news is legitimate. Yet I never expected to see such outrageousness myself. Of all the foolish edicts, I've never met a mage worth the cost of a cup of ale myself. And today you've met three," I said smoothly, "and it is not yet noontime. What other novelties will this day hold, I wonder? Look, here come your men, and my hostages," I said, before he had a chance to retort. Rondal led the boys across the causeway, and they seemed all in good spirits. Unarmed, of course, but unbound, wearing warm clothing and heavy cloaks against the chill. Of course, Sir Ganulan had his hood over his cursed face, and would not look up to face his father. Sir Festeran spoke for the rest of them. When prompted by Sir Brommel, he told the story of the ill-conceived quest Sir Ganulan had declared against the evil, dispossessing mage lord. He related details I had not been privy to, how the entire idea had been the scheming young Sir Cerberus, who had bullied and shamed Sir Ganulan into the rash course, and then forced Sir Festeran and their squires to participate. After that, he described each battle. He spoke of the duels in simple terms, without elaboration, and left no doubt in anyone's mind who the victor was. He then assured his liege that their captivity had been quite gentle, and the hostages well treated. Sire Gimbal was not impressed, especially with the role his hot-headed bastard son had played in the scheme. He was even less happy about losing the income that Brestol had provided, and livid about the ransom I was asking for the hostage's return.
"It's preposterous, you taking advantage of mere boys that way," he growled scornfully. "They're no more than barely weaned pups. They are belted knights," I reminded him, grown men in their own right. I tried to talk them out of it. They insisted.
"Mage Lord Minilan speaks the truth, sire," Sir Festeran said earnestly. "He attempted to dissuade Sir Ganyalan and Sir Cerberal several times, but they would not relent. In the end, he was forced to entertain them."
How could a gentleman not oblige such a challenge to his honour? I was actually starting to enjoy this, using the chivalric code against this gamecock. That got under Sire Gimbal's armour. He snorted derisively.
"A baker's son speaks of honour. This is a day for novelty."
I felt Sir Kay tense, but he did nothing. "He's met my father. There's no one alive who could challenge his honour, commoner or not, and Sir Kay looked ready to defend the point on my behalf. Thankfully, Sir Brommel was more diplomatic than his liege.
"We concede that you are indeed the lawful lord of Brestol Vale," he said, not that they had any choice in the matter,
"and we acknowledge that the boys, the knights, were not kidnapped, and that there was a lawful duel," he said with a heavy and slightly exasperated sigh. "You have bested them fairly, and Sir Ganyalan quits his claim to Brestol. You have made your point, Mage Lord. Must you demand ransom as well?"
"Is that not the custom?" I asked innocently. "Sir Kay, you informed me it was the custom."
"That is what I was taught," Kay agreed deferentially. "But perhaps the River Lords play differently than the Wilder Lords." He had insisted that any problematic issues be blamed on his faulty instruction, even if it was a poorly disguised pretense. I wasn't thrilled about berating him like that in front of my foes, but I had to admit it was a pretty common practice for lords to blame their subordinates for such things.
"Now, that is the custom," agreed Sir Brommel, keeping his liege from saying something angrily. "It just is unseemly for a new-made knight to take advantage of other new-made knights," I pointed out. "They came to me, remember, and all of us were belted within the last year. Still, I might see my way clear to negotiate," I said, heaving an affected sigh, "in the interests of good relations."
"And just how much will your good relations cost Westflannia?" Sir Brommel asked again.
"I am not unreasonable.
We need not even resort to coin if you wish. Perhaps we could return the squires, their arms, mounts, and armour for 3 wagon loads of grain and 100 weight of salt pork. A bargain, really."
Gimbal's lip twitched, but Brommel spoke before his master could say something to undo the peace.
"That would be a gracious compromise," he agreed hesitantly. "Actually, it was quite generous on our part. Even a squire's ransom was worth significantly more than that, from what I understood, and right now I needed food as much as I needed cash. More."
"And the 2 knights?"
"For Sir Ganyalan," I said, studying the cloaked figure with a calculating eye. "Perhaps merely, 100 chickens. Laying hens, I'd prefer, but a few cockerels."
"In honour of his device,"
I added with a chuckle. "I do enjoy eggs."
"Chickens?" Brommel asked. "You want to ransom back my lord's son with poultry? Unacceptable."
"Fine, fine, throw in as many additional goats as you think the boy is worth and we'll call it even, but only if we keep his armour and mount." This really was fun.
"Goats and chickens," Sir Ganyalan said irately, speaking for the first time. "You wish to exchange me for goats and chickens?"
"Well, he was willing to settle for just the chickens," Rondol pointed out.
"Shut up! Father, you have no idea what hells they have put me through. And now this outrage."
"Shut up!" bellowed Gimbal. "If you had the sense to wait as I had bid you, boy, we would not be here.
Chickens? Goats? 200 chickens, then, 12 cockerels, 20 goats, and 5 mules for the
good night,"
spat the warbird.
"For his mountain sword, what would you have? Potatoes? Carrots?
Clearly he was insulted by the idea of haggling for his son with livestock and produce.
"Cabbages?" suggested Rondol. "Two wagons full for the mount?"
"I do like cabbage," I agreed.
"And for the sword, a lovely old antique, I was tempted to keep it for my collection," I added impishly, "but I'm sure it has sentimental value. For the blade, how about 4 barrels of ale?"
Brommel nodded, his face growing paler. He couldn't exactly say no. The sword was worth thrice that, easily.
"And now for that pretty armour. Well, my apprentice Sir Tyndall has grown quite fond of it. Still, I suppose he could let it go for bide, if you will."
I closed my eyes and spoke mind to mind with my apprentice.
"Tyndall, what do you want for that armour?"
"What?"
"I want the bloody armour," he replied, shooting me a dark glance.
"No, we have to ransom it back. It's the custom. You can only keep it if he doesn't agree to the ransom. And we're being generous, so don't ask for the world. Just tell me what you want, and hurry."
How about some clothes?"
he asked plaintively. "I've got 2 sets, and one of them is torn all to hell."
"Well, let's see." I opened my eyes and saw the Westflarian delegation staring at me curiously. "My apprentice, Sir Tyndall, would be willing to ransom the armour for 6 sets of fine clothing, 2 sets of travelling clothes, 2 pairs of boots, a fur mantle and a light woolen mantle for summer." That was a princely sum, but still a fraction of what the armour was worth. It took a skilled armoursmith months, perhaps even years, to complete a set of riveted chainmail, and longer to properly burnish it. In contrast, it usually took the ladies of a castle a month to produce 1 set of finery at their looms. Of course, a professional tailor could produce a set in days, using professionally woven cloth, but somehow I guessed Gimbal would not rise to that expense.
"As you wish," Sir Brommel agreed, reluctantly. He was still getting a bargain.
"Now I will deal with the matter of Sir Cerberal when he surfaces," I conceded. "I would not have you pay ransom on a corpse or a bandit, and then there is the matter of Sir Festeron."
"Let me guess," Sire Gimbal spat. "You have a sudden desire for a piggery."
"Actually, I will only accept a money ransom for Sir Festeron, 200 ounces of silver, or 50 of gold." The 3 knights looked at me like I had sprouted a 3rd head.
200?
Scoffed Sir Arental. I think he was drunk.
"Has the boy started shitting gold?"
"If he had, the ransom would likely be much higher," Rondell observed. "In fact, he is the most valuable of the hostages in my estimation," I said smoothly.
"How so?" asked Sir Brommel. "He is the son of a poor knight, more a glorified yeoman whose service was valuable to Sire Gimbal's father and rewarded by knighting him and his sons."
"And he's a bloody lousy fighter," snorted Sir Arental, earning a look of reproval from Brommel,
a snort of involuntary laughter from Sir Gimbal, and a look of pure hatred from Festeron.
"I saw him practice in the yard. I could drop him half drunk," he boasted. "Which would make you twice as sober as you are now, sir,"
Sir Kay said with a cool sneer. He had learned to hate Sir Arental, if for no other reason than the condition in which he'd left Sevendor. If Mage Lord Minolin has deemed Sir Festeron the most valued prisoner, then he sets the ransom. You may pay it, negotiate, or abandon him, with the knowledge that such an act by a liege to his vassal would violate the terms of their oath," he added sternly.
"The lad is not my vassal. His sire is,"
Sire Gimbal dismissed. "I'll ask the poor man if he has 50 ounces of gold to throw away on a youngest son. Considering his tribute to me is no more than 20 ounces of gold a year, I think that we might have to consider a smear on my honour." He looked the young knight up and down, as if he were seeing him for the first time.
"He may have served in my household, but I bear the boy no love. I'll pay 20 silver. No more."
"Then it seems Sir Festeron will remain a guest of Sevendor," I pronounced. "Since his liege will not meet my price, we will have to find some other way. Send his father and I will treat with him. But the rest, I expect payment of all of it. Save the garments, within 2 weeks. Bring it to this spot by the next full moon, and we will exchange the hostages and their gear."
"That suits us well enough," conceded Sir Brommel.
You shall have your poultry, Sire Menelon, and your pretty clothes, and you may keep Festeron, if you love him so. My lord is a man of honour, and will see your groceries delivered in full.
We expect no less, Sir Kay responded. We only ask that you do not task Sir Erenthal to the job.
Why? Asked Sire Gimble, suddenly interested. The man is but a guest in my house, but I trust he discharged his duties in Savendor and left with just his sword, mount, and the clothes on his back, as he has often told me.
As to his stewardship, Sir Kay replied, fixing the man with a stare, we expect to recover fully from it with time and treasure, but based on his stewardship, I would not trust the man to take a goat to market without counting the number of legs when it arrived, or even, perhaps, its virtue.
Sir Erenthal growled and reached for his hilt, though Sire Gimble stayed his hand easily enough.
Sir, if we were not in truth, I swear that we should have words for such an insult.
The decrepit excuse for a knight barked at my castellan.
I look forward to the conversation, Sir Kay said,
his eyes narrowing. It would be a pleasure to cut the heart out of the man who raped this poor country for so long. Indeed, the peasantry would celebrate for days, and I haven't killed a man in at least 3 months.
When was the last time you faced a fighting man with a sword, Sir Winesack? You doubt my courage,
Erenthal shot back. I doubt your ability to recognize which end of the sword to grasp, if you must know, Sir Kay riposted coolly.
Sir Kay can be quite imposing, as my tenants knew, and when he was angry you could feel it. Sir Kay may have acted as an administrator, but that was secondary to his chivalric duties. He had Sir Erenthal by half a head in height, and his long arms gave his long sword quite a reach. I knew from personal experience that he, at least, knew which end to grasp, and how to employ the blade to devastating effect.
Our next opportunity, then, Sir Erenthal said,
a little more reluctantly.
But it wasn't Kay's size that intimidated Erenthal, I realized. It wasn't that Kay was larger, more fit, and had more recently seen combat. It was the profoundly resolute manner in which he approached the incipient duel. Usually, I'd noticed in my observations of knights and mercenaries dueling over stupid reasons on campaign, quite against orders, but you can't stop them, there was a lot of bluster, combined with opportunities to back out from committing to the fight. It's all part of how the militant nobility and men in general let off steam, and usually it can be reasoned out without bloodshed, if the parties are willing. But Sir Kay displayed none of that. This was not bluster, nor was his insult idly given. He had decided that Sir Erenthal needed to be punished for his tenure as steward, and he was more than happy to usher the knight off to the afterlife on that basis alone. There was no redemption for his mismanagement in Sir Kay's eyes. It had violated his sacred duties as a gentleman knight. I could have pointed him toward a dozen other lords I knew who were as bad or worse, but it wouldn't have mattered. Savendor was Sir Kay's charge, and like an adopted orphan, he felt belligerent toward those who had abused and exploited it. You can face a man who is angry. You can face a man who is vicious. But a man who is determined and certain of the righteousness of his course can scare the unholy hells out of you, or so it appeared by Sir Erenthal's face.
I find I anticipate the discussion greatly, Sir Kay nodded graciously. It was perhaps the most menacing thing I've ever heard him utter. Best I intercede before someone stupid broke the truce.
Until then, I trust you gentlemen can find your way back home, and as a special gift and a token of our good faith, I will release your son Ganyalan to you now. That took them all by surprise. On parchment, Ganyalan was the most valuable bargaining piece, but then the game I was playing wasn't the same one they were. They saw getting Ganyalan back as a victory. I saw Ganyalan leaving as a victory. He had bullied and harassed his fellow prisoners and driven Tyndall near to cursing him further. I had to intervene, riding all the way to Brestold Tower to keep there from being any bloodshed.
A noble gesture, Sir Brommel said, approvingly.
It is my pleasure, I bowed. As a new father myself, I understand how attached you can become to your son, and I have no doubt whatsoever that you will fulfill your obligations honourably, I added.
Of course we will, Brommel said, smoothly but unconvincingly.
I was guessing he would be willing to advise writing off the three squires and Festeren the moment they were out of sight with Ganulin in hand. And to ensure his prompt attention to his duty, I continued, as I reached over and yanked the hood off Ganulin's striped head, I will be happy to remove the wizard's mark on his face the moment the conditions of our negotiations are met. Young Sir Ganulin's pimply face was now adorned with a bright red snowflake across it. It was a simple spell, a minor enchantment affecting the capillaries around the face, and it was easily reversed, for a mage. It took a few moments of yelling accusations and demands and an impressive amount of swearing before Gimbal was willing to accept that the spell was not harmful, save to Ganulin's vanity, and it could be removed in an instant. He glared at me evilly after that. I had to explain to him what the symbol was, and point it out as the new device of Sevendor and its mage lord. Sir Gimbal saw it as an insult, of course, and I could tell the move had changed the tenor of our negotiations. I wasn't just an up-jumped baker's son playing at being a lord. I had affected his family line. Until his sow of a wife gave birth to a son, this bastard was the only male heir he had at the moment, and I had branded him with my badge. "When our business is concluded, Mage Lord," he said in parting, "perhaps we shall have more. The conquest of Bristol Vale was perhaps not technically legitimate, since the domain had no seated lord. But it has one now," he reminded me. The warning was clear. Sevendor was a legal target of conquest now. "I would consider mightily before making such a fateful decision, Sire Gimbal," Sir Kay said. "We Bovali have learned quickly how to fight, and in my experience we lack neither courage nor strength. We've been exiled from one homeland. We aren't likely to flee another for any agency less compelling than the dead god's legions." "I will speak not of war," Sir Gimbal said, motioning for his retainers to clear away the tables and stools. "For only the gods know what the future holds. But while I will not declare myself your enemy, you have not made a friend of me this day. Now allow me to flee this miserable hole in the mountains. I have seen the mage lord everyone is talking about, and I am not impressed." He and his entourage stomped off, a dejected Sir Ganulin trudging behind them. He had to ride double with a squire, much to his dismay. We waited until they were out of sight before we escorted our remaining guests back inside. "You know he's on a bound to do something stupid now, don't you, Mage Lord?" Sir Kay observed. "Was it ever really avoidable?" I countered. "He was never going to be our friend. Fine. But I might have bought us more time, and I certainly bought us enough food to ensure we get to the spring without famine in Sevendor."
"If you don't mind me saying, Lord Minolan," Festeren offered hesitantly, "you were not wrong about my lord's character. If anything, you underestimate it. He will come at you, for he hates to be humiliated more than anything, and you have embarrassed him more today than any man has ever dared."
Sir Kay and I both looked at him thoughtfully.
"Well, that's good to know," I smirked.